The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Things We Said Today, a Beatles talk show podcast that we do every 2 weeks on YouTube, and it's also heard on many audio platforms. On this show, we talk about anything we feel like with the Beatles, the past, the present, their history, their music, individual songs, any particular aspect we want to, we can talk about here on this show. I'm Ken Michaels. I'm one of the three regular co-hosts of the show, and I do hope you know me for my syndicated Beatles radio program, heard on over 50 radio stations at the present time, called Every Little Thing. I also do another talk show podcast called Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast, which is also biweekly on YouTube and audio platforms as well. And I have my own YouTube channel, Ken Michaels Radio, which is all Beatles-centric. Lots of conversations about the Beatles with authors, musicians, friends, anyone that wants to talk about the Beatles with me on that channel. And we have our two other regulars on the show. First of all, a man who has been part of New York radio for about 40 years on New York's WFUV and does incredible interviews, programs amazing music, and has done a number of Beatles specials through the years on the channel. And that's our own Darren DeVivo. Hello, Darren.
Hello. Hey, everyone. What's happening?
It's kind of difficult to pry Darren out of Citi Field these days, but we're very grateful that you can make it for the show this time.
I had to squeeze it into my schedule.
I figured you're just glued to the same seat for several days, but
you're right about that, especially in the heat. This heat, I've been melting in that seat. So,
well, I've been enjoying watching all the games, and it's an exciting time right now for the Mets and for the Yankees too. And with that, we welcome our Yankee fan, the only one amongst the three of us, and he is known for many years working in the classical department at the New York Times and for writing a few Beatle books, including Got That Something, How the Beatles I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything, and The Beatles from the Cavern to the Rooftop. And coming out December 13th, I think that's the date.
Yep.
Part one of the McCartney Legacy, which he has written with Adrian Sinclair. And we are all waiting with anticipation for that book. And, you know, it's funny. I went to Amazon just to bring it up. And right below your book, yours is right at the top. Right below it is Tune In from Mark Lewisohn. So back to back, you and Mark Lewisohn, perfect company right there. Alan Kozin, welcome.
Thank you, Ken. And hello, Darren. And hello, everyone out there.
On today's show, I thought we'd tackle a subject on Lennon and McCartney. This is one that I've been wanting to do for a while. And it's not anything like comparing them so much as who you prefer as an artist, who was better. For a number of years now, I've realized that the more that you study these two men, there's a lot more similarities between the two of them, I feel anyway, once you study them as musicians and artists, and also as people, and how they conducted themselves in public. Once you put it all together in one great big ball, once you examine the two of them, there's a lot more similarities, at least in my opinion anyway, than differences. But we're going to talk about both the similarities and differences between John and Paul in just a few moments. But first, as we always do, we have the latest in Beatle news. And as I'm sure most of you know by now, I certainly hope all of you know, Variety magazine wrote an article on the forthcoming box set on the Beatles album Revolver. An official announcement is expected in September. Already, a rumored track list has been getting around. And while it looks to be the real thing, we still have to say, to play it safe, that it's still a rumor. The details of which are that there will be a disc that is the new remix for the album, plus two discs of outtakes, a disc for the mono version of Revolver, and a four-song EP, which has the new 2022 remixes for the single that was recorded at the same time, Paperback Writer and Rain, and there are also mono mixes for both those songs. Nothing has been said as of yet whether or not there will be a Blu-ray, high resolution, or surround sound. No official release date has been given yet. We've only heard sometime in October. Would either of you like to comment about these rumors and what you think so far? Alan?
Giles did go on Twitter and had a link to the Variety article and wrote, "Hope you like it." So that makes it sound pretty definite, but the contents weren't given in Variety. They've been given on Facebook by various people, but it's definite, obviously, or else Giles wouldn't have said, "Hope you like it." I do think, you know, there are certain, I can't wait to hear it. I mean, just that, despite what I'm about to say, which is, you can fit both the mono and stereo mix of Revolver on one CD, and they're given a CD each. And come on, guys. And you could probably fit Paperback Writer and Rain on that CD too. And even if not, you could fit it onto one of the other discs. I mean, even if it goes on one of the outtake discs, it doesn't matter really. But we're getting five discs that could be, you know, it looks like three discs. I'm sure there will be a Blu-ray. I just think that we haven't heard about it, and it will, you know, be the same thing that the Blu-rays always are of these things, which is a surround mix and a high res version of the new mix, and maybe a high res version of the original mix. Who knows? But anyway, you know, the outtakes, there seems to be a lot of outtakes of Love You Too. There seem to be a number of outtakes that we've actually already had in anthology or on bootlegs. The or on bootlegs thing, I don't know, you know, I've always said as a theoretical concept that even if it's out on bootleg, I'd be happy to buy an official version of it. And it's only because they haven't put out an official version of it that I've got them on bootleg. So the bootleg duplication, okay, can't really complain about that. I'm not even complaining about the stuff that's in anthology, because it'll probably be a different mix and it'll probably be revelatory in a different way somehow. So I'm really looking forward to the outtakes, looking forward to the new mix too. Supposedly it was, you know, Giles was saying months ago that going back earlier than Pepper, he had sort of a problem because of the transitional mixes that were done, or the way even the basic tracks were recorded with, say, bass and drums together on a channel, and the limitations on how he could separate and remix those things. But the reports I've heard are that he was able to use Peter Jackson's MAL system, which separates, you know, using artificial intelligence, and has made a lot of things possible for him that weren't possible when he made those comments. So it's all very promising, and look forward to it.
That's interesting you say that, Alan, because when Peter described the whole MAL system, my mind started to race as to what the possibilities were. It's endless what you could do with that kind of technology and separation of different instrumentations.
I thought about how I could use MAL at home. That's where I went immediately into. But I completely agree with Alan. I was going to say the same exact thing, that I kind of get the idea of separating certain elements for convenience sake, or dare I even say, those of us who are anal retentive, everything has its place. The main album, the mono mix. But when you're talking about, you know, dollars, and there's other, you know, there's a book involved, there's the mixes that need to be on a separate disc, the Blu-ray, it could be combined. The EP idea bothers me more than separating stereo and mono. I don't know. It's a lot easier for me if I had the box set and I'm going to listen to the mono mix now, to take the mono disc, put it in, then take the main disc and go up to track number 15. You know, so, I mean, that's splitting hairs. What I think they should have done is, I don't know how much of a demand or need there is, but getting the U.S. mix involved would then set a precedent. If there's going to be box sets going back, hearing the U.S., that would definitely then allow you to get not what came out on the U.S. Albums box set, but more along the lines of what was coming out on those earlier boxes, the Capitol years. They never finished the series with the third volume. You know what I'm saying? To get the U.S. mix of Revolver, but more importantly, Rubber Soul, which was very different, and perhaps even include Yesterday and Today in the Revolver box set, or another one. So, and maybe that still could happen. In another way, Revolver US is very similar. It's UK minus three songs, but by doing that, you'd end up now setting a precedent for what to look forward to in earlier, you know, box sets. If there is a need, a demand, it'd be the third time the US mixes came out. The US albums came out, although, like I said, the box set from 2014 was a bit controversial because it was like the standard mixes. It was the U.S. albums not sounding like the U.S. albums, just that the songs were, you know, in the right order with the U.S. album packaging. Another random thought about Revolver. Just condensing the discs, lowering the cost, but, you know, when the Red and Blue albums came out on disc initially, the controversy was the Blue album especially could have fit on one.
No, the Red album.
The Red album, rather. Sorry, the Red album would fit on one. But there, you know, they were double albums originally, and the Blue had to be two CDs. So to be anal retentive, you make that part of it I got. And so, you know.
Okay. Well, I hadn't thought about the American mixes, you know, applying that to this whole idea. And I think that probably Universal and Apple look at that as something completely separate.
Yeah, they could even say we did that, been there, done that.
Yeah.
And they'd be right, I guess. Although, again, the Capitol, what is the box? The U.S. albums, it's called, that came out in 2014. To me, that was... I mean, it looked good, but it was like, you know, I want to hear those bad, what was his name? Dave Dexter. If I'm going to listen to these albums, you know, I want to hear them the way I heard them when I was 11 and I had just got Beatles 6 for the first time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the way that I feel, I have very extreme feelings. On the one hand, I take the attitude of, at this point, what are we complaining about? I'm happy to get anything. And the Beatles don't owe us a thing. If nothing ever came out ever again on the group or in their solo careers, I feel like I've been spoiled to death, you know? So on the one hand, I'm grateful that anything comes out at this point. But at the same time, I also think, and I used to never feel this way, that everything the Beatles have ever done should come out. Every outtake, you know, only because they're the Beatles. They're the biggest band there ever was. They're the most influential band that ever was. And I know that's probably never going to happen. So there has to be some kind of compromise. But my main gripe about this whole thing is what the two of you have said. What is this about another four-song EP? What a waste of a disc. You know, it's just padding the bill. It's the same thing they did on the Let It Be box set. And also, you may disagree with me, but I know the mono mixes were important and everything, but why can't people just buy it separately, individually? Why does it have to be put in this box set? Why are you forced to get the mono mixes along with the new remix? You know,
interesting.
Controversial, and people say, well, that's the way the Beatles listened to it, you know. But at the same time, they were always kept separate, you know, or in a box set.
That's why I feel like these box sets should sort of be the definitive catch-all. In the case of Revolver, you get stereo mix, you get the mono mix. I even would consider, you know, we talked about this, I think, back with maybe the White Album box set. Mm. We're getting Giles Martin's modern day remix of these albums.
Right.
What about the original mix? What about the person that doesn't want that guitar solo brighter than it was in 1968, in this case, 66. Now, are we getting too redundant? Putting a 2022 mix, original stereo mix, original mono mix in the same box? I don't think so. Not when there are box sets that are being manufactured where you get the album on vinyl and CD. That's mm-hmm. redundant. Mm-hmm. You know, when you got to spend $100. The Beatles haven't done this, but there have been plenty of other artists where I've actually said, you know what, I don't need the double heavyweight vinyl to, if you're giving me everything on disc as well, separate them. I'm a CD person, slightly more than vinyl. To me, CDs are superior sound-wise. Here come the emails. But that's redundant when you're getting the album twice in two different configurations.
Well, like in the George Harrison All Things Must Pass big wooden box, you got both the vinyl and the CDs.
Yeah, well, see, well, in that case, that was you're getting part of his friggin' trees on his property. You'd expect stuff like that. But, you know, here's some dirt from the backyard. And the little cardboard toilet paper rolls last used in the... But, you know, when in the case of Revolver... You know, all right, you know what, maybe if you're going to give us all these discs, treat Rain and Paperback Writer like they were bonus tracks to the album, separate them with like they did those, what was it, the British McCartney CDs that came out in the early 90s. Give us like a 10-second gap of space so the album, you could have a sense to breathe and Paperback Writer doesn't immediately come up after Tomorrow Never Knows and blows the whole vibe of the whole thing because it's not supposed to be heard like that. Put the bonus tracks, the B-side and A-side as bonus tracks. Give us the US mix, give us the original stereo and original mono, and give us Giles Martin's updated look at it so we could hear everything brighter and a little, you know, a little different. And then you could fit all these surround sound mixes. A lot of them seem like they could fit on a one Blu-ray disc because you could get a lot on a Blu-ray audio disc.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, much more than a conventional CD.
Should point out about this EP idea with the, you know, four track kind of things. Apple, it's not very green. You know, like it's one thing to put out a CD with that's packed with music, but to put out a CD that's mostly empty, that's kind of a waste of materials. It's kind of a waste of carbon footprint. You should reconsider this.
There you go. Well, you know, I have a feeling that probably once the entire Beatles catalog is gone through with giving the archival box sets, going all the way back to Please Please Me, they're probably going to remaster the original mixes of the albums all over again. You should actually do it periodically to make it sound even better than it was before, since the last time was 2009. It's a long time now, actually. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if there's money to be made there, and if the music can sound even better than it did in 2009, do it.
So. Now that we've really thrown lots of criticisms and critiques and whatnot, we could forget about getting our free promo copies.
Well, you know, still, like I said, I'm glad to see this come out anyway. I'm happy to see any Beatles product come out. So, along with the buzz surrounding Revolver, there hasn't been any official word yet about the rumored sometime in New York City box set, which, if true, would be coming out on John's birthday, October 9th. At least that's the rumor. Now, you might remember that back in 2012, a compilation came out of Christmas songs from various artists called Holidays Rule. Well, just announced that this compilation is coming out for the very first time on vinyl. This is the collection that featured Paul McCartney's version of the Christmas classic, The Christmas Song, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. It also had the group The Shins covering Paul's Christmas classic, Wonderful Christmas Time. This collection is due out September 30th and is now available for pre-order as a 2-LP set pressed on translucent red vinyl housed in a gatefold jacket.
And you know next year, Holidays Rule 2
yep.
is coming out on green vinyl, the second volume.
Hey, if there's money to be made, they'll do it.
This is true. And I'll be buying them.
There's also going to be a limited clear with red and green splatter variant
Ooh.
Available exclusively at the Kraft Recordings store. You can go to their website, kraftrecordings.com, and you can order it right on the website. BBC News is reporting that a new statue of Beatles manager Brian Epstein has been unveiled in front of a large crowd in Liverpool. It is located near the former site of Epstein's NEMS record shop in Whitechapel. The statue marked the 55th anniversary of Brian's passing on August 27th, 1967. Jane Robbins is one of the statue's sculptors, and she also happens to be Paul McCartney's cousin. Paul said of the statue that its depiction is, quote, dead good-like.
Dead good-like?
Yep, those are the words.
Paul said that or Yoda?
Paul said...
He could have probably come up with a better word than dead good.
Okay. Bruce Spicer's book on Rubber Soul and Revolver has an official release date of October 10th on Amazon, but I have been told you can buy his book now on his website, which is beatle.net, and it will be sent to you now in the mail. You can get the book before it comes out on October the 10th.
Okay.
Again, that's beatle.net. Speaking of books, this is definitely front page news. With only the new book on Paul McCartney from Alan and Adrian Sinclair rivaling it. The new book, You Dirty Old Man, the authorized biography of Wilfred Bramble. This is by David Clayton. Bramble is described as one of Britain's most loved and complex character actors. Along with his classic role as Paul's grandfather in the film A Hard Day's Night, Bramble became a household name when he played the role of Albert Ladysmith Steptoe in the British TV show Steptoe and Son. Alongside Fame and Fortune, You Dirty Old Man reveals how Bramble suffered unbelievable personal heartache, battling an inner turmoil that eventually drove him to drink as his marriage collapsed in the most deceitful circumstances imaginable. His torment led to a secretive life off camera where he did everything possible to stay out of the public eye. This features original interviews with film directors Richard Lester, Terence Davies, and Tony Palmer, as well as recollections from his own family members. The book has already been released. I can just see it. Alan's book, Wilfred Bramble, battling each other. Bestsellers.
Is that Blood, Sweat, and Tears, his former lead singer that wrote the Bramble biography? What's the author's name?
David Clayton.
Not David Clayton Thomas, no.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
All right, another book of interest coming out. It's on January the 15th is Peter Asher, A Life in Music by David Jacks, covering every facet of Asher's career, from recording artist to producer and from managing artists as well. Asher's 60-year career has been extraordinary, and he's produced artists from nearly every genre of music. A truly remarkable life covered in this book. Many thanks, as always, to John Bazzini for providing all this news about new books of interest to Beatle fans. Coming out on September the 23rd is the very last studio album to be recorded by the late Dr. John.
Oh, yeah.
The album's called Things Happen That Way. And on it, he covers the Traveling Wilburys song, End of the Line. Huh. And that version also includes Aaron Neville singing on the recording. We have a couple of passings here to note. The death of Jerry Allison at age 82. Allison was the original drummer in Buddy Holly's band, The Crickets. The other original members along with Buddy were bassist Joe B. Malden and Nicky Sullivan on guitar. Sullivan quit the band after just 1 year, and he died in 2004. Malden was with the Crickets from 1957 through 1960, and for a long ride after that, 1976 until his death in 2015. Jerry Allison was the mainstay in the band throughout its entire run, despite several personnel changes. Of course, we all know that Buddy Holly was a major influence on the Beatles in many ways, a complete package, singer, songwriter, guitarist, and even towards the end of his life involved with producing. And as often has been told, the Beatles got their name from Buddy's band, The Crickets, using the name of an insect and inserting the A in the name, referencing a musical beat. Jerry Allison was also important because he co-wrote some of Buddy's hits, That'll Be the Day and Peggy Sue. The Beatles made their demo of That'll Be the Day at Percy Phillips Studio in Liverpool, along with their original song of In Spite of All the Danger. John Lennon covered Peggy Sue on his rock and roll album, and Paul McCartney acquired the music publishing catalog of Buddy's. And in 1989, the Crickets released an album called T-Shirt, for which the title track had involvement from Paul McCartney. He ran a contest through his quarterly magazine Club Sandwich, asking his fans to submit a song for the Crickets to record for their new album. And one lucky person, Jim Imre, got to have the band perform his song T-Shirt, and Paul played piano, contributing backing vocals, and he produced the track. The album had Jerry Allison and Joe B. Malden playing on it, and Gordon Payne as lead vocalist. With Jerry Allison's passing, it means all the original members of the Crickets are sadly no longer with us. And finally, the Canada-based animator, Gerald Potterton, has died. He was known for his work on the Beatles animated film Yellow Submarine and the 1991 cult classic Heavy Metal. Born in London, he won acclaim for the Liverpool sequence as shown early in Yellow Submarine while the song Eleanor Rigby was playing. The National Film Board of Canada announced that Gerald died in a Quebec hospital, saying in a statement, Gerald came to Canada and the NFB to be part of a new wave of storytelling, one that was fresh and irreverent, and he brought great wit and creativity to every project. He was also a builder, helping to lay foundation for today's independent Canadian animation industry with Potterton Productions. He was an exceptional artist and a truly nice man. Potterton was 91. All right, that's all the news that I have for you this time. As I said before, our show this time is about Lennon and McCartney, exploring the similarities and differences in both men. And I thought it would be a great idea to do this because, you know, so much has been said through the years about how different the two of them were. But at the same time, the contrast between the two of them really helped to make the Beatles interesting. All four of the Beatles made major contributions, no doubt, to the band, as did George Martin, Brian Epstein, everybody around them that worked closely with them. But I thought that we'd all talk about, and I came up with my own list, as the two of you had, of how the two of them are actually, in some ways, maybe more similar than different. Maybe the two of you disagree with me. I don't know. I'm going into this blind, not knowing what the two of you have come up with. So why don't we start with Alan? Let's start with similarities and what you came up with between John and Paul.
Yeah, you know, I sort of see them as actually quite different. But for similarities, I mean, in personality, what's one thing that's often mentioned is the deaths of their mothers at a young age. That's something that at least they had in common. They already were close friends by the time John's mother died. So can't say that that really brought them together, but they could sympathize over it. They both were drawn to basically the same early rock and roll. I mean, they both were Elvis fanatics, Buddy Holly fanatics. Their formative influences were the same, even though their musical styles were sort of different from the beginning and became even more different as they went on. This one is sort of hard to describe, but there is an interesting thing that they shared, which is a dichotomy between being supremely ambitious and supremely lazy. You don't think of McCartney particularly as lazy. You know, this is a guy who's constantly working, constantly doing, you know, project after project, some of which we don't even find out about for a long time. But yet there are certain things like, you know, and you could argue whether this is laziness or just a different approach to things. But for instance, his idea about lyrics not being important. And, you know, if you don't just sort of get it, you know, the first time you write it down, that it's, you know, it's not necessarily worth laboring over. You got the impression that Lennon labored over lyrics a lot more than Paul does, you know. And yet, you know, one thing I found when working on the book is that if you look at Paul's lyrics closely, despite the fact that he said that, there's quite often a lot more going on than appears on the surface. With Lennon, the laziness is more like things like, you know, if they didn't have to go into the studio to do an album.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
He'd happily just sit home and, you know, do whatever else he was doing. And it was really Paul that would draw them in. And also in John's case, the laziness, so to speak, ended up sort of inspiring a certain kind of creativity, not even just among the Beatles, but among EMI's engineering staff. The best example being that he loved to double track his voice, but hated to bother singing it twice. So, you know, ADT, automated double tracking, was invented entirely so that John wouldn't have to bother singing it twice. But then Paul used it plenty too. You know, I suspect that Paul was perfectly happy singing it twice, but once that capability was there, you know, he used it as well. And in fact, you know, in when he was recording Ram and working on it in L.A. with the engineer Eirik the Norwegian, Eirik Wangberg, he said at a certain point, you know, can we put ADT on? Can we just use the ADT rather than double track something? And in that case, it wasn't because he was too lazy to double track it. It was because it was going to be sort of an improvised scat vocal. And you would have to then memorize the improvisation, memorize the nonsense syllables that he was doing. And, you know, there's no need for that if you can use ADT. But Eirik said, what's ADT? Because this was a proprietary EMI technique. They ended up calling up EMI and getting Ken Townsend to describe to them how to do it. And even at that, I mean, it's really sort of an aside, but even at that, they weren't able to use the ADT because you need an extra track for that. And they didn't have an extra track. So what he ended up doing is finding little spaces on all of the, you know, 16 track master, I think it was, where, you know, the first three words can be on this track, the second three words can be on this track. And Eirik had to sort of punch in real fast, but Paul still had to learn the nonsense syllables and the scat melody. So that was sort of the opposite of lazy, but he would have used the ADT if it could have been done. He just didn't want to bounce down to free up a track. Let's see what else. Okay, here's another difference, but also similarity in a certain way. We know that John was really into doing political songs at, you know, the late end of the Beatles time, in the early end of the solo time. And if he had a political cause that he wanted to sing about, he would make a point of doing it. Whereas Paul really didn't like political, topical stuff. He gave interviews saying that he finds protest songs kind of boring. He didn't want to do it. And yet, when Bloody Sunday happened in Ireland, he was right there. And, you know, he wrote a song the next day, went in like a day or two after that to record it, you know, white hot. Now, some of that may have been influenced by John, but also in a way you could look at it as a similarity, you know, that if you feel deeply about something, you want to do it, even if it's something you don't normally do, in his case, political songs. Mm. He just wanted to go in and get it out. Now, partly it may have also had to do with some taunting that John had done shortly before that. John compared him to this person named Mary Whitehouse, who was a British busybody who, you know, was always saying that, you know, the British morals were being corrupted by British TV shows and pop music and all that stuff. And John, just to needle Paul at a certain point, said, you know, your politics are like Mary Whitehouse. And then, you know, it's possible that, you know, being stung by that and then having Bloody Sunday happen, Paul is saying, you know, I'll show you. And sat down and did give Ireland back to the Irish. But in a way, you still could see that as a similarity, because John wrote two songs about the situation in Ireland, and where John got Instant Karma out almost immediately, he sat on the Irish songs, and, you know, until it wasn't until like I think September they came out in England. I think they were out a few months earlier in the US on Sometime in New York City. But he didn't do anything to rush them out. Paul wanted to rush them out. He wanted it to be like Instant Karma, and felt that it's more important than Instant Karma in a way. You know, this is a situation happening now. He spoke out about it. He gave interviews. He, when the BBC banned it, he chafed against the ban. And in another way, you know, John's stuff didn't get banned nearly as much as Paul's did. You know, Paul had several things banned by the BBC: Give Ireland Back to the Irish, High, High, High. You know, if not for Mary Had a Little Lamb in between there, you know, which is a difference from John. I don't think John would have ever done something like Mary Had a Little Lamb, but I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something that you will come up with. Did Beautiful Boy, you know, yeah. You know, they both in a way did songs for their kids. You know, they were different kinds of songs, but nevertheless, you know, there was that. They both also, it presented itself in a completely different way. But in the way that John was always with Yoko and wanted to be seen as John and Yoko, one word, Paul, in a way, was that way with Linda. You know, Linda didn't have to be in Wings. She didn't really want to be in Wings. Paul roped her into that, and because he wanted them always to be together, and that aspect of it she liked. So, so there is that, the, you know, Paul and Linda, John and Yoko, that they did it differently. They presented themselves differently about it. Paul did it in terms of, you know, sort of home and hearth, warm family, kids, all that stuff. And John and Yoko did it more as, we're both avant-garde artists, but, you know, fundamentally it was the same thing.
I was going to ask you about that, because going back to the very beginning, when we started doing the show with me and Steve Marinucci, sometimes when we had authors on, in particular, Steve would always ask this question. Do you think that Paul brought Linda into Wings because John did everything with Yoko? Was he trying to copy John in any way? You know, and I see a similarity there, because John and Yoko were so creative together in every way, and each other's music. John went and fully supported all of Yoko's artwork, you know, and what Paul did with Linda, you know, he wanted to be with Linda all the time. He could have just had Linda and the kids go on tour while Wings, you know, is touring the world or wherever, and Linda not be in the band. But she was in the band, and she contributed her keyboard playing, and she contributed her harmonies. And, you know, I'm sure you're going to go into detail about the songwriting of Paul and Linda in your book. But Paul did say that she did contribute somewhat. She did influence some of the songwriting there. So they were very close together. And in a way, you know, just as much as John supported Yoko, Paul supported all of Linda's endeavors, her photography work.
The food.
Yeah. So there's a strong similarity there. But does it all start because John was so close and wanted to do everything with Yoko? Your opinion on this?
I don't think so. It's possible, but I think it came from a different direction. And in both cases, but especially in Paul's case, well, I don't know if you can even say that. In both cases, they were broadly attacked by, you know, fans who felt, you know, in John's case that Yoko, you know, led him down the garden path to the evils of avant-gardeness. And in the case of Linda, it wasn't even that she was, you know, a malign influence on him. They just didn't feel that she was good enough to be in the band and attack that. And both of them nevertheless sort of stuck by them and said, this is what I want to do, you know. And Linda too, you know, Linda, you know, as she said, we have some of the best stuff in the book is quotes from Linda, I've got to say. I mean, it, you know, there's one point where she's talking about all the criticism that she's taking, and she said, yeah, Paul said, do you want to be in the band? And I said, okay, I must have been out of my mind. You know, like that. I mean, you know, and she was aware that she was doing this. She was getting a lot of criticism. She was doing it because Paul wanted her there. And if Paul wanted her there, she wanted to be there, you know. And she, you know, I have to say, it like never got better. She took the criticism for her entire life in a way like Yoko still is. You know, John isn't even here anymore. We still hear all about, you know, Yoko. But Linda, you know, if you listen, remember in 1989, I mean, that's pretty late. I mean, it's less than a decade before she died. And that soloed vocal came out of, you know, from Hey Jude. You know, people were still sort of, you know, on her case. So, you know, she endured quite a lot, as did Yoko, and as did Paul and John on their behalf. So that's similarity. I mean, you know, whether or not Paul brought Linda in because John and Yoko is almost irrelevant, because it took on a life of its own. you know, and he stuck with it. And that's what he wanted. And that's what John wanted. So there's a similarity in a way, you know.
It's well put. By the way, I should point out that, you know, since I've had this idea to talk about the two of them and how similar they are, Madeline Beccaro, who we just had as a guest, who wrote the book on Yoko, she sent me this quote from Linda saying, you know, but John and Paul were a lot more alike than you know. So that just kind of put the bug in me again to do something like this kind of show. Do you have any other similarities?
I think for the moment that probably is it for me. You know, they were basically very strong-willed people. I mean, there's a similarity, as different as that sometimes made them seem, because they were strong-willed with different opinions about how things should be. You know, if you look at the whole Alan Klein thing, you know, Alan Klein versus the Eastmans, all that, I mean, they were willing to compromise when they felt that compromise could be a good thing, but when they didn't, they both stuck to their guns, you know, really strongly. I mean, you know, it was very hard to sort of move them from a position that they believed in. So that's a similarity too.
Okay. Some good ones right there, Alan. Darren, how about you?
I've always felt that on the surface, there were more differences than similarities between the two of them, but that's what made them work as friends, as a songwriting team, and as musicians. It was the differences that attract. I really do think that sometimes the best pairings are when the individuals are very different. Which nobody watching this would understand, and it's sort of odd that I would bring this up, but like, I sort of look at myself and my wife, we're a good couple together because we bring two completely different personalities and ways of thinking and doing things together. Mm-hmm. And they feed off each other. And in the case of John and Paul, I always looked at John as being the true Teddy boy. And Paul had the tendencies of being that, but Paul was more the good kid that would go to the store and, you know, buy milk and not disappear because he couldn't get the brand cigarettes that he wanted when he went to get the milk. But yet the fact that they were both like that, they had their own ways, their own personalities, that made the picture whole. And John, you know, Paul points out that example. And when it came to songwriting, like, we're getting better, Paul getting better, it's getting better, and John can't get much worse. Well, there the differences really worked together. Wouldn't have worked if they both thought the same way. It's getting better. It's getting better. Oh, it's great, isn't it? You know, that doesn't work. I always looked at John as more of the angrier of the two, and Paul more of the mild-mannered, maybe capable of managing his emotions better. Could very well have been a very emotional time. He could have been an emotional time bomb, Paul, with certain things. We don't know that. He's suppressed it, managed it. John's emotions he wore on his sleeve. Mm-hmm. And again, even when the breakup came, when the Beatles broke up, Paul was quiet for the most part about it. John was the one after the breakup happened that would throw Paul under the bus and bash a new McCartney song, would criticize, would be outspoken. His words and his comments would have barbs to them.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that wasn't the case with Paul. If anything, Paul said nothing, in a nutshell, about the relationship. So again, opposites here in the way they dealt with things. I like what Alan mentioned about them both being lazy and yet at the same time motivated. It sounded to me like once John was active again in 1980, he got extremely motivated. We heard that the plans were already in place for the follow-up to Double Fantasy. Double Fantasy no sooner came out, and the impression we get is that Milk and Honey was not going to be all that far behind. Mm-hmm. And a tour was coming, and he had these ideas that were flying out of his head, and there was an eagerness there. And we've seen Paul do be like that, but we've also seen them, you know, we've also seen instances where I think John lets some subpar material go out. Maybe something could have been written better or produced a little better. McCartney, I think you can make a very strong case that any laziness as an artist is in his lyric writing, because we've heard Paul write stuff that is powerful lyrically.
Yeah.
And then we see things that, what was I listening to recently with McCartney? I mean, even lyrics on McCartney 3 compared to some of what he's saying on Egypt Station, two albums that were side by side, they almost seem like they were written by different lyricists in some instances. McCartney could be extremely lazy with his songwriting, with his lyric writing. And I felt that sometimes John came off as maybe being a bit lazy with the production of his records or... you know, it was a bit of a sloppiness from here to here, which was endearing, but that could be perceived as laziness. So, I mean, really, in a nutshell, I could randomly pick out and repeat things that Alan said. And I've always looked at them as being mostly opposite, but that's what made it work. I mean, John always had the chip on his shoulder, like I said, and Paul was the more... personable, agreeable, calmer,
mm-hmm. rational
individual. So really, I mean, that's where I actually feel it worked for them. Similarities. Well, I guess in some instances I look at them after the breakup. At the beginning, it seemed like John was all for the breakup happening and the Beatles ending, and it was over. The dream is over. It was Lennon who suggested it first. It was Lennon who got mad that McCartney went public mm-hmm. and made it a news item. I mean, is it that important, John, that you be the one to break the Beatles up? You know, because John was angry that it was McCartney that looked like the guy that broke him up. But then years later, we start hearing by the mid 70s about how they were getting along. They were hanging out together. And you almost get the impression it was John who wanted a reunion to happen more than Paul. Paul didn't need it as much anymore. And there, Paul was the confident one with wings. And John had doubts. We know about his lack of self-confidence sometimes. So their opinions about where they stood and where the Beatles stood had reversed by the middle 70s. Whereas John seemed to maybe need it more than Paul would have needed it, but it never happened.
I don't know if I agree with that necessarily, but...
I'm sorry, you don't?
No. I mean, I know that Paul was disturbed by the constant Beatle questions in the 70s. But then you also hear about when he signed his contract with CBS, that there was a provision in the contract that he would be allowed to record with the other Beatles again. So, you know,
I'm not saying that Paul was against that happening. It just right. felt to me that John hit a point where it seemed to me, just reading between the lines and things that we've heard through the years in interview segments, maybe even from later in the 70s, where John seemed more willing to talk about it and more open-minded to it happening. Paul didn't really need it to happen and didn't, unless pressured, talk about it. He had wings. He had a lot more going for him.
Well,
my perception now, but again, I see where you're coming from, though, Ken.
John always, you know, depending upon his mood, he could be completely against the Beatles reunion and then warm up to it. You know,
it's contradictory. He was always like that. Yeah.
And you just don't know overall. I mean, I'm sure that's all part of what made John who he was. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that when he gave interviews, he was honest in all of his opinions for the moment. Yeah. Every time he said that. But you never know. Nobody knows what would have happened had John not been killed. Although that's a whole other, you know, topic, because I used to say all the time that I don't think the Beatles would ever have reunited all four of them. But then again, if the three of them got together for the Beatles anthology without John there, if John was alive, would the four of them have done it?
I'm sure he would have.
You know, for something like that, something that special.
There is a common kind of assumption that when it came as to being individual musicians, that Paul was more of the melody guy, mm-hmm. and John was more of the lyrics guy, the mm-hmm. word guy. And you could come up with examples that contradicted that. And I know some people have said that's absolutely not the truth. They were both strong in both departments. And I feel like, no, I think that was the truth. I think McCartney was when push came to shove, was going to come up with the better melody than John would. More times than not, it was going to be the reverse with the lyrics, John being the stronger of the two. And that is kind of mirrors my thinking about their personalities, that more times than not, they really were different, you know, opposites. They were different, but that's what made it special. And it wouldn't have been, you know, it might not have worked as well if they were both like two, you know, similar. I mean, you could just see McCartney. In the Get Back movie, at the very beginning, when you sense the tension in Twickenham, John shutting down, John goes quiet. John seemed to be turned off and was like, he could come up with a whole bunch of places he'd rather be than be right there.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul turned it up a notch and tried even harder to make, you know, was more enthusiastic about the whole thing. Two different approaches to that period of time in their lives, ultimately, for at least a brief period of time, they did end up coming as one unit, as we see later on in that month, later in the movie. I actually did sort of semi just lose my train of thought, but I think I got back to where I needed to be there.
You and I think we see things very differently. This, you know, I agree with some of the things that you have to say, but I do believe that when it comes to lyrics, what John said about Paul is true. He could be a great lyricist when he wants to, when he puts the effort.
Yeah.
He had the same ability to write great lyrics as John did. It all depends upon whether or not he wanted to do it.
Yeah, maybe that's actually a better way of putting it. They were both capable of doing what the other one did best. And maybe in Paul's case, it was laziness when it came to lyrics. Maybe John wasn't quite the strong melody guy. I don't think anybody is equal to McCartney when it comes to, you know, composing music and melodies. And I think McCartney's the best, period, regardless of who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But John, I think when it comes to words, John's right. Yeah, Paul could keep up with him. But Paul would let his, you know, kind of, Paul would, what's a good way of putting it without saying Paul would just sit back and not try? Because I'm not thinking he didn't try, but the effort was never 100% always with Paul.
Oh, it depends upon
as a lyric writer.
You know, each one is a different case. But I'll tell you something, the lyrics book, when it came out from Paul, changed my head a bit, because there are certain times in his songs where you think that what he's writing about is just, you know, words that fit the melody and they make sense and, you know, it serves a purpose, but there's more of a meaning behind it. And I wouldn't have thought that way had that book not come out. So it could be that his lyrics mean more than we're led to believe. You know, you tend to pick on certain lyrics through his career and not know the hidden meanings behind some of them, like Dustbin Lid or, you know, Salamander or words like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the more that you learn, you realize that there's more to his lyrics than we're aware. And yet there are times when I do feel that he is lazy with the lyrics. But I do agree with the way that John saw him in that regard. And I do think that John was just as capable for writing great melodies as Paul was. But there was such an easiness with Paul that it didn't take that much effort for him to come up with great melodies. It just oozes out of him.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Paul was also because Paul tended to be more active and was the, you know, wasn't generally speaking a lazy artist. He might be, again, he may have been lazy at times with lyric writing again, or maybe some other aspect, but all told, he was not overall a lazy artist. Paul also, as a result of that, needed a filter more than John did, I think. And that's where John stepped in. He was Paul's filter when they were working together. And Bogey Music would not have come out as a Beatles song if the Beatles stayed together another 10 years. You know, that would not have happened, that song. Nor would John have brought a Bogey Music. And I love Bogey Music. Don't get me wrong. John would not have brought a Bogey Music to the table. You know, and some people who don't like that aspect of McCartney's work might cite a song like Bogey Music as an example of Paul being a lazy writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, how do you know how John would have felt about Bogey Music? He seemed to like the studio version of Coming Up, which was very quirky, and he liked experimentation. So you don't really know how he would have felt about that. And at the same time, if you're talking about filtering, notice how the other Beatles didn't want What's the New Mary Jane to be released by the Beatles. So there you go there.
Valid points.
They also didn't want Cold Turkey to be released. As right. And that was a great song. You know, I wouldn't have minded the Beatles doing Cold Turkey. Yeah, but yeah. So, yes, they needed each other to bounce off each other and filter each other. But that's not to say that, you know, every decision that they made, you could have predicted or that they were the right ones.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing I wanted to note here is that both Darren and I have been talking in terms of Paul being lazy in terms of lyrics. And, you know, maybe in a way, neither of us are being fair there because Paul, you know, basically has said he just doesn't put as much stock in lyrics as other people do, as John did. So is that laziness or is that, he places a different value on it than, you know, other people. And, you know, it's maybe just simply a value judgment rather than laziness. So maybe I should just sort of amend that slightly. Whereas John really was concerned with lyrics, Paul was less concerned with them. And then, you know, taking into account what both I and Ken have said about, you know, looking into his lyrics, like Ken mentioned the lyrics book, sort of changing his mind about, you know, what some of these things mean and whether they actually mean anything. And turns out that there are meanings that he has that we didn't necessarily know about. So partly, you know, our impression about Paul's lyrics is Paul's fault for coming out and saying, yeah, I don't care about lyrics that much, you know, but maybe he does. And he's just sort of fending off the criticism by saying, yeah, that's just not what's important to me.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't care about lyrics that much. Why would he put out a book of his lyrics?
Yeah. You say there's some.
Yeah, there's a lot not in the lyric book where he skims out the lesser songs and, mm-hmm. you know, and puts the cream of the crop in there and gives off the impression, look, I am the lyricist.
Oh, there's a lot of really good songs he left out of there. He should do a volume two.
But, you know, it's like what you and me, Ken, right now. This is what kind of what I'm talking about with John and Paul. We are John and Paul. No, okay. Your opinions tend to differ from mine in this show a little bit about how we view John and Paul. Another example would be our love of Ringo's music. Uh-huh. You have embraced virtually all of, in one way or another, all of Ringo's albums. And I have sometimes been critical of certain ones. And listening to you and your opinions have made me listen to these records differently mm-hmm. and have influenced me positively and have really helped my enjoyment of these albums in a way I probably never would have occurred to me. Here are ways of thinking fairly differently about a topic have ended up benefiting at least me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same thing here with John, who was that kind of like a curmudgeon, and Paul, who was, you know, perceived as being the happy-go-lucky fun Beatle, and it put them together, and you have a happy curmudgeon. You have a perfect kind of matching there.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of podcasts, is to have different opinions, and we all can influence each other, you know. Mm-hmm. Sure, the two of you have said things that have made me think differently about certain things. Same thing with my other podcast show. But I will say that the more
wrapping up this love fest now.
No. The more that I think about the two of them, the more that I see similarities. So I thought that I would list what I put together here. But some of them are fairly obvious, and you may not even think they're worth bringing up. But first of all, they're both geniuses. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They're both absolutely brilliant at what they do. I would say they're both type A personalities. They're both leaders. I think in every group, just about every group, you have to have people who take charge and lead, and others that are happy to be in the group. I don't want to say a lesser role, but I think that George and Ringo fit John and Paul perfectly. And even though George was very frustrated, especially towards the end, as he was getting better and better with his songwriting, and he wanted his songwriting to be noticed more, he didn't want to be the leader. He didn't want to be what John was or Paul was. You know, I think that, John and Paul were the leaders of that group. And like you were saying, Alan, that Paul was the one who had to get the band together and to, you know, if John was ever lazy, he was the one that rang up all the others. Let's get into the studio. He's the one that started new projects for them. Even though you watch the Get Back, Let It Be film, and Paul is saying to John, I'm not that comfortable being the de facto leader, you know, but the two of them were. And, you know, I don't think you could have seen George or Ringo in that role within that band. So I think they're similar in that regard. We just touched on this. I think they're both great lyricists. But like John said, Paul is a great lyricist when he wants to be.
Yeah.
Both capable of writing great love songs and rockers. This whole idea that John was the rocker and Paul was the balladeer. Well, sometimes they were.
That's Paul true. Yeah.
Helter Skelter.
That's a misconception, I think.
Yeah. Paul gave us Helter Skelter. He gave us I'm Down. He gave us I Saw Her Standing There. You know, there's a lot of great rockers in the Beatles catalog, and then carrying that into his solo career. And John, come on, some of the best ballads in the Beatles are In My Life and
If I Fell.
If I Fell. I think Julia is very underrated. Beautiful song. Across the Universe. And in his solo career, look at Woman and Oh My Love and Jealous Guy and Love, you know. Those are stereotypes that people have been mentioning all these years about the two of them, and they don't benefit either one of them. They're both great at what they do. They're both great singers. They're two of the greatest rock singers of all time. Both married non-British women. You think about it. They ended up, you know, John marrying Yoko and Paul marrying Linda, and now Nancy. Both married women that they allowed to be very influential in their lives and collaborated with creatively. You know, I think Yoko really influenced John and turning him on to the avant-garde world and a completely different way of thinking in conceptual art. You know, the life that Paul and Linda had and how much they enjoyed, you know, protecting animals and how important that was and the vegetarian lifestyle and the closeness of the family and all that. Well, I think Paul was always very comfortable being a family man from the very beginning. There is a difference between the two of them. John used to be jealous of the fact that Paul would, you know, pick up a baby and cuddle him, and, you know, and John couldn't be as affectionate. But he learned that later on with Sean. But like I said, John and Yoko, Paul and Linda, both working together creatively, both married women that they presented as talents in their own rights. Okay, Paul, like I was saying, he would always support Linda with her photography work, with the vegetarian meals. And there were times when Linda gave interviews completely on her own with Paul in the background, you know, behind the screen. He didn't want to take any attention away from Linda because he knew that if the two of them were together, it could very easily turn into a Paul McCartney interview. Both John and Paul were very prolific as songwriters. You know, you did have that 5-year gap when John took didn't release anything. But I think at any given time, despite what you hear about him losing his muse, he wrote songs when he felt like writing songs. He spent the last 5 years of his life raising Sean, doing some cooking, baking bread. It might have been overdone about the baking bread, vacationing, watching television a lot. He did what he wanted to do. I don't think that he couldn't write then. And we do know from all the bootlegs and the Lost Lennon tapes, it's a whole pile of songs that he was writing in the second half of the 70s, and even some in the early 70s that didn't get released. Whenever he wanted to, if he really put the effort in, he could have written at any given time. I don't think there ever was a writer's block with John. And what can you say about Paul? How much more prolific can you be than Paul McCartney? Like you were saying, Alan, similar influences, 50s rock and roll, and all the big name rock and rollers. And I also do believe that both John and Paul liked pre-rock music and the standards. And Paul mentioned that when Kisses on the Bottom came out, and he would cite a couple of songs that John liked that were not rock songs before rock and roll. And that showed up in their music too, because anytime that you had these introductions in their songs in the Beatles that were separate from the rest of the song, like the beginning of If I Fell, or Do You Want to Know a Secret? That was influenced by pre-rock and roll music. Right. Both have big egos and yet are very insecure. And I see that a lot in people that have egos. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be critical of them, but you could be the most talented person in the world and still be insecure. You know, and I think as Paul has had so much success in his career, and I'm sure he could be content with all that he's achieved, there's a part of him that still wants more. You know, I'm reminded of Paul talking recently about one time John said to him, "Do you think I'm going to be remembered when I'm gone?" Like, what a ridiculous thing. You know, of course. Paul said, of course you're going to be remembered when you're gone. But, I mean, John was always bothered by the fact that Paul kept banging out so many songs, and he would write a few, and Paul would come into the studio with more. You know, I think that kind of affected him. Whereas Yoko, I believe, gave John a lot of confidence and made him feel, you know, you're great on your own. And Linda did the same thing for Paul, I think. You know, mm-hmm. They both helped John and Paul become, you know, a bit more independent, realizing that they're talented completely by themselves. They both were involved with artwork beyond songwriting, with painting and drawing. And yeah, and you mentioned that both John and Paul lost their mothers at an early age. And I think, though, that there is a difference there because Paul still came from a very adjusted family life. You know, he was always surrounded by his father, his brother, aunts and uncles. And John had that too, but his mother and father abandoned him. So that always kind of affected John. But I still think there was some kind of bond there that they felt because, you know, John lost his mother when he was, what, 17? Paul lost his when he was 14. They can relate on that level. They both show concerns about events going on in the world, both very charitable, both ambitious. You know, for as much as John said that, you know, he cared more about what he was saying and with his music, I know that Paul was also quick to point out that, you know, John would complain about when Brian had them wear the suits, and Paul would say, well, I don't remember John complaining about it. He did whatever he had to do at the time, because it was very important for John, for the Beatles to make it. They both were extremely ambitious in that regard. So, you know, those are the similarities that I found. Do you want to talk any more about the differences? Either one of you?
I feel like I've pretty much expressed more differences and have kind of exhausted, you know, without for fear of repeating myself.
Yeah. I just have a few when it comes to differences.
There are some similarities that are also differences. If you think about, you know, John wanting to sort of, you know, break the mold and push into other things like doing Revolution Number 9, wanting Revolution Number 9 to be a single, stuff like that. Wanting to do, you know, a song like Strawberry Fields was really completely different than anything they had done up to that point. You know, you didn't listen to many of their lyrics and say, what the hell is that about, you know, without thinking that it also isn't, you know, in literary terms, a really interesting, well put together lyric. And then I Am the Walrus, that kind of thing. You know, John is pushing in a different direction, and yet Paul also pushed in different directions, but did it on a more macro level, you know, coming up with this idea of, you know, how about if instead of being the Beatles, we're the Sgt. Pepper Band? How about if we do a film that we just direct and we have no script? Let's just go do it. You know, or, you know, what became the Get Back, Let It Be thing. Okay, now let's go back and do stuff that we can play live and record it live. Let's do a live album. We have, you know, originally 19 days to get this thing together with all new songs and go out and play after not having played for 3 years, you know. And the heart of that difference is something you can see in the Get Back film, where they're about to go, you know, the day before the rooftop concert, and Paul kind of doesn't want to do it because Paul is saying, look, we do this and, you know, this just becomes a documentary about us making an album. So big deal. And John says, yeah, but making albums is what we do. But Paul had a bigger concept than that. Paul didn't want it to be just about making an album. He wanted it to be something they hadn't done. You know, and so Paul, you know, in a way, John was always pushing to do different things that the Beatles hadn't done, but in terms of specific kinds of songs, specific kinds of writing. And Paul wanted to do things the Beatles hadn't done, but in a sort of more massive way. You know, this album should be completely different. This film should be completely different. You know, like that. And that's in a way a similarity and in a way a difference, you know.
That was excellent, Alan. That was, you know.
Why, thank you, Ken. That's why they pay me the medium bucks.
They pay you?
Well, no, not for this.
You know, one of the things they say about the Beatles that made them special, one of many, was that they didn't really want to duplicate what they had already done.
Right.
So it all depends on how you look at it. Because if in John's mind, what we do is make albums, if he's always thinking in terms of albums, that is repeating yourself. But it's how you present yourself. There's all different ways of making new albums in terms of production. Do you make it more produced? Do you scale it back and make it raw? Do you make them songs that we can do live in front of an audience? Or do you create songs that are more complicated? The Beatles were always, you know, trying out new things. So the few things that
I have a footnote to something that you said earlier.
Yeah.
You pointed out that they both married non-British women. And in Paul's case, you know, Nancy and Linda. But they also both married British women and both divorced the British women that they married. I don't know how significant that is. It's just
there you go. See, it's more similarities here, Alan. In differences, we already kind of discussed this. Their public personas were very different. John spoke his mind. Paul was very careful about everything that he said and more private most of the time. Working in the studio, John went for feel, often lacked patience. Paul at times was a perfectionist. He varied in his approaches in recording. In the studio, both men knew what they wanted, yet would consider other ideas from musicians and producers. That's what I've heard about the two of them. Yeah, I think so. And that's pretty much it. Oh, differences. I've said this before. I think Paul thrived on the competition between the two of them, whereas John was, I think, more threatened by it. And that would be it. That's what I came up with for differences.
That's I'm not sure John was threatened. I'm not sure he was threatened so much as, you know, when he talked about coming up, for instance, it was sort of like, this is a good track. Now I'm going to have to do something, you know. I think he felt spurred on when he felt Paul had done something good. I mean, he often sort of made it seem as if he didn't think Paul was going to do anything good. I mean, in the Rolling Stone interview, he says, I think Paul, you know, has a good album in him, and then adds, but I don't think he can do it twice. You know, I bet he did think he could do it twice. I think sometimes he would just say things like that just to needle Paul. Sure. But I think it was pretty clear that when Paul did something that worked, that John liked, he felt like he had to get in there and do something himself, you know? So I'm not sure if it was threatened so much as, you know, claiming that Paul wasn't going to do it, but when he did it, being inspired by it.
I don't know about that, because I'm always reminded of, like I mentioned before, I think it was Magical Mystery Tour. John said that he came in with two songs and Paul came in with 11. You know, he was always bothered by the fact that I Am the Walrus was the B-side of Hello Goodbye. And I think that towards the last few years, he was seeing that Paul was every bit on his level. You know, some might argue even doing better than John was. So, you know, I think that kind of bothered him.
Maybe.
You know? All right. So I think that we've said as much as we can say, at least at this moment, on this subject. And I would certainly love to hear what you guys watching this or listening to this have to say. Please write to us here.
This is truly a topic that there is absolutely no accurate, correct, right, wrong. You know, we've taken every angle and I think we've kind of twisted them around to make to come up with a different conclusion. They were different and they were the same. They were the same difference, really, the two of them. And that's what was the magic.
Yeah, well,
that's what made it work.
It worked in the Beatles, and it worked on their own, you know, because of their individual talents being so supreme as they were and still is with Paul. All four of the Beatles have had successful careers more than any other band that split up. So why don't we go around the table here, the round table, the virtual round table, and tell folks what we've been up to. We'll start with Darren.
I haven't been up to much, actually. go to my Facebook pages. That's the best way to keep to get in touch, keep in touch, stay in touch. Two pages. One is Darren DeVivo. Send me a friend request. Or there's another page which you'll find if you did a search that you could click follow or like or whatever the button is called this week on Facebook. And as for listening to WFUV, I can be heard Monday through Thursday night starting at 10 till 2 a.m. and Saturday afternoons from 1 to 4 at 90.7 FM in the New York metro area. But if you're outside that, you can stream us anywhere. WFUV.org is our website, or we have an app you can download, and that's a great way to be able to listen wherever you are. And really, that's the deal with me.
Okay. Alan, how about you?
Okay. What I've been up to is basically working through volume two. I'm so far sort of stuck in the early months of 1974, but 1974 turns out to be a really interesting year. And I'm looking forward to getting a little further into it than I am. But, you know, it's the process of just like with the first book, you know, it's there's always interesting stuff happening and you always are looking forward to getting to the next little hurdle. But you sort of got to get there. And it's coming out pretty nicely, I think, if I say so myself. Otherwise, I should point out probably that when the book comes out on December 13th, on the 14th, Adrian and I are both going to be at the Grammy Museum in Newark, New Jersey, at a event sort of hosted by Ken Womack. And I think Ken is curating an exhibition at the Grammy Museum, a Beatles exhibition that runs from November through June. And so our event is on December 14th. We'll both be there. Not sure what we're going to do. We can either do a presentation or Ken can interview us or some combination thereof, and we'll have books and we'll be signing them, and probably a rare opportunity for the two of us to be on the same continent at the same time. So if you want a book signed by both of us, you should turn up. Anyway, if you want to get in touch with me, I've got two Facebook pages. One is just Alan Kozin. The other one is Alan Kozin Remixed. I guess that's the sort of, you know, special Giles Martin page, you know, the remixed page. you can also reach all of us by email at thingswesaidtodayradioshow@gmail.com. We've been getting a lot of email lately at that address, and some people presenting some interesting ideas, possibly for future shows or just to sort of discuss things further that we've been talking about. And you know, people also have been commenting a lot on the YouTube version of these shows, which is the video version, which we hope you're watching and we hope you subscribe to. If you just want an audio version, we're on Podbean, and Podbean distributes to all kinds of other places like Apple, iTunes, or iPodcasts, or whatever it is now. I believe also to Google and iHeartRadio. We're all over the place. So if you're listening to this, you already know where to find us, but we hope you're watching on YouTube. Anyway, I think that's about it for me. We also have a Twitter feed at Things We Said Fab. And yeah, that really is it for me.
All right. As for me, you can write to me directly at my email address, which is everylittlething@att.net. On my YouTube channel, which is Ken Michaels Radio, a couple of interesting shows I did in the last 2 weeks, one of which was just a fun conversation with the simplest idea of all, gathering together some Beatle experts and talking about what we feel was the Beatles' best album, going by their UK albums. So I did have Tom Hunyadi and Joe Mayo, both of which are part of my Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast podcast. And you also know Tom from his Two Legs solo Paul McCartney podcast. Joe Mayo has his own channel, Mean Mr. Mayo. Dylan Seavey, who is a frequent guest on my show and on Two Legs, a Nashville musician. And he drums, plays guitar, is a songwriter, and he is extremely insightful and knowledgeable on Beatles and solo Beatle music. And John Montagna joined us. He was a guest here on our show. He's a bass player. He has performed in Alan Parsons' group. He's also been a part of the Happy Together backing bands a few times. And he's been at the Fest for Beatle Fans, where he's run bass clinics going through Paul McCartney's work in the Beatles, especially the Abbey Road album, which he did not that long ago. So we just talked about what we all felt is the Beatles' best album. And once in a while, I'm going to bring back that whole idea and invite, you know, anyone I want. And you guys, of course, are invited whenever you want to discuss this. It's interesting to hear different opinions. There is no definitive answer. No matter how you skin the cat, you can make a case for all the Beatles albums, what you think is the best. But it's just a fun talk. And I also interviewed Madeline Beccaro, who was our guest on our last show. She wrote that brand new book on Yoko Ono called In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. Asked her a lot of questions that we didn't tackle here on Things We Said Today. My radio program called Every Little Thing, my Beatles radio show. Brand new show is going out this week on many of my radio stations. I do a thematic set of life songs. Songs that have the word life in the title. This is the second time I've done that. And also on my website, I've mentioned from time to time, there is a page for Every Little Thing where you can look up all the radio stations that carry the show, when they run them, links to their websites so you can stream them. But something brand new just happened, because up until now, Every Little Thing was never available on demand. Up until now. One of the stations that airs Every Little Thing, and that's WFDU, that's Fairleigh Dickinson University Station, where my show runs Sunday mornings at 6 a.m. Eastern Time, is now posting shows to stream on demand. There are many different shows. So if you want to listen to Every Little Thing, and you don't want to have to figure out what specific time it runs on a specific station, you can just go to their website, which is WFDU.fm. Click on the tab that reads HD1 Recent Archives. Now, my shows will be posted shortly after the live broadcast, the Sunday morning at 6 broadcast on the station. And each will stay there on the on-demand page there for 2 weeks. Okay? So at your leisure, you can listen to Every Little Thing during the week, whenever you want on WFDU's website, WFDU.fm. All right. And there'll be another Talk More Talk soon. We will be reviewing Ringo's new EP, EP3, very soon. And some of the panels, I believe, from the Fest for Beatles Fans will be posted soon on the Talk More Talk YouTube site. So that particular show, which is all about the solo Beatles, well, most of the time, you can find on YouTube at Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast. If you can, please subscribe to that and to Ken Michaels Radio. And then there's my website. Almost forgot that. KenMichaelsRadio.com. There's Beatles trivia there every single week where you can win one of 10 prizes. This is my most recent prize. Lennon, the Mobster and the Lawyer. I talked about this. It's by Jay Bergen, who is John's defense lawyer and the whole Morris Levy Chuck Berry's You Can't Catch Me being a line used from that in Come Together. There was a whole lawsuit, and it takes you through the entire time that this took place with John's own testimony, which you can read right here in the book. And Jay has signed the copies here to give away if you want to win that brand new book here from Jay Bergen. All right. I think that's it. This has been a fun conversation. And as I said, I'd love to hear what you guys have to say. So please write to us. And like Alan said, write to us with ideas for the show, because we read everything that we get here. And we appreciate your support of the show, whether you listen or you watch. And for Darren DeVivo and Ellen Cozen, this is Ken Michael saying thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Let's go Mets.